Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, October 7th, 2015, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to a special Courthouse Steps edition of the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call, as today we'll be discussing the death penalty in the Supreme Court. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome to our call today a returning expert, William J. Hahn. He's an associate at Hunton & Williams right here in Washington, D.C. He was good enough to attend the oral argument, take some notes, and bring us his remarks today. He'll speak to us with opening remarks of about 10 to 15 minutes, after which he's going to take questions from you, the audience, so please do be ready with those questions when we get to that portion of the program. With that, Mr. Hahn, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Dean. I thought I would begin by just briefly discussing the facts of these cases, absolutely heinous facts, but it's important, I think, to understand how the cases got to the Supreme Court, both procedurally, factually, and then also placing the case and the party's arguments into some context before then moving on to just some observations from the questions at oral argument and a sense as to how what the justices asked fits into this broader discussion and debate the country's engaging in on the death penalty. The state of Kansas, in its briefs, had characterized the actions of the Carrs brothers as one of the most heinous and notorious crime sprees in the history of Kansas, which included a carjacking where the brothers forced the driver at gunpoint to withdraw money from ATMs, abandon him in a rural area after taking his watch and shooting a tire in his vehicle, shooting and killing a woman they followed to her home, and breaking and entering into a home shared by three young men and two women, stripping them of their clothes, forcing them to commit various sexual acts, taking one of the men from the house to withdraw money from ATMs, raping one of the women twice, raping or attempting to rape one of the other women, forcing the other men and one of the women to withdraw money from ATMs, and then after forcing them all into a car, they drove them out to a soccer field, forced them all to kneel in a line, and then shot each of the victims five times in the head, respectively, driving away afterward. Miraculously, one of the women survived, and she ran naked and barefoot in the snow for more than a mile and called 911. The facts surrounding Gleason's violent crimes are equally terrible. He was convicted of capital murder and first-degree murder for two different murders and was sentenced to death. The victims of his double murder accompanied Gleason in a robbery that he had committed of an elderly man after Gleason had spent 2.5 years in prison for attempted voluntary manslaughter for shooting a man three times. The Carrs were jointly tried and convicted of numerous criminal counts arising from their crime spree, including felony murder and four capital murders. Both Reginald and Jonathan Carr were sentenced to death for the four capital murders and received a life sentence each for the felony murder count and additional terms of imprisonment for their numerous non-capital convictions. When these cases reached the Kansas Supreme Court, with respect to the Carrs had affirmed 32 of the 50 convictions, but the court reversed the death sentence, finding three constitutional errors in the penalty phase. First, that the Eighth Amendment right to an individualized sentencing determination was violated by the trial court's decision not to sever the Carrs brothers' penalty phase proceedings. Second, that the Sixth Amendment right to confrontation was violated by the admission of hearsay in the sentencing phase with respect to Reginald Carr. And third, and this was really the primary issue that was argued at the court today and what has inspired these cases to garner so much attention, is that the trial court's failure to affirmatively inform the jury that mitigating circumstances need not be proven beyond a reasonable doubt violated the Eighth Amendment. This third question is the real common question in the Gleason and Carrs cases, so I'm going to focus the majority of my comments on this issue with some discussion about the severance positions that were taken with respect to the Carrs brothers at oral argument. The court did not act on the Confrontation Clause question. With respect to this question of affirmative instructions about the mitigating evidence and the burden of proof with respect to mitigating evidence, the Kansas Supreme Court's basic reasoning requiring an affirmative instruction was that Without one, the jury was left to speculate as to the correct burden of proof for mitigating circumstances, and the reasonable jurors might have believed that they could not consider mitigating circumstances that weren't proved beyond a reasonable doubt. Thus, in the eyes of the Kansas Supreme Court, jurors may have been prevented from giving meaningful effect or a reasoned moral response to the defendant's mitigating evidence, implicating the defendant's right to individualized sentencing under the Eighth Amendment. This issue, as I mentioned, was also before the Kansas Supreme Court with respect to Gleason's murder conviction, where they reversed his death sentence. The court in Gleason also identified how the Kansas capital sentencing statute was silent as to any burden of proof for mitigating circumstances, a distinction that, in its view, is meant to operate in favor of capital defendants. So this raises another question that would come up at oral argument, as I'll explain later, that deals with whether the Kansas Supreme Court's decision was truly under the Eighth Amendment or whether it was under Kansas law. That raised a number of questions at the argument today. Generally, with respect to the briefing before the Supreme Court, the state's briefing in both Gleason and Carr emphasized the following points. First, that the Kansas Supreme Court's decision was in conflict with the decisions of other state Supreme Courts on the affirmative instruction question. Second, that the Kansas Supreme Court misinterpreted the Supreme Court's precedent to reach a conclusion that's never been held by the Supreme Court, that the Eighth Amendment requires states to adopt or bars them from adopting any specific standard of proof with respect to mitigating circumstances. And that three, if allowed to stand, the decision would invalidate the death sentences the juries have imposed on at least two-thirds of the inmates currently on death row in Kansas. The respondents argued, in turn, that the Eighth Amendment bars jury instructions that impose a reasonable doubt standard on mitigating evidence, reasoning that, as the Kansas Supreme Court did, this bar is an extension of the individualized sentencing requirement under the Eighth Amendment. They also argued that the instructions were reasonably likely to cause jurors to apply a reasonable doubt standard to mitigating circumstances. And they also argued, finally, that the Eighth Amendment prohibits jury instructions that are ambiguous as to what mitigating evidence may be given. Gleason also contended that, as I indicated earlier, that the Kansas Supreme Court's decision ought to be construed as one applying Kansas law rather than the Eighth Amendment, which makes this issue one of state prerogative. So, interestingly, though, there is little argument in the briefing about whether the Eighth Amendments should be applied as an original matter to specific jury instructions when, as a matter of its text, it only speaks to certain punishments. And to an extent, this became an issue during oral argument when discussing some of the Supreme Court's cases. A rhetorical question from Justice Scalia kept reoccurring, have they read our cases? This is a recurring theme through much of the commentary today. There didn't seem to be much of an appetite in the oral argument today from any justice to question the fact that the Supreme Court has never held that the Eighth Amendment imposes a specific affirmative instruction with respect to mitigating circumstances and the burden of proof. The closest I would say that came to being articulated was in a question from Justice Breyer, where he mentioned that, well, the court hasn't held that before, but maybe it holds it today. Really, the focus seemed to be, at least initially on this affirmative instruction issue, was whether the Kansas Supreme Court was relying upon state law in making this determination or whether it was relying upon the Eighth Amendment. It seemed as if from their questions that both Justices Sotomayor and Ginsburg took the position that Kansas was really relying on state law here. They tried to emphasize the fact, particularly at the outset, Justice Sotomayor did, that the state had changed its jury instructions subsequently, its form instructions, to demonstrate that there needed to be an affirmative instruction, and that this was the go-forward practice, and that from this we could presume that Kansas was interpreting state law when the court made this decision. But the state rebutted that claim, pointing to the conclusion of the Kansas Supreme Court's decision, which relied upon the Eighth Amendment, the fact that Kansas and that also the Kansas itself had faced comparable questions before the Supreme Court in cases like Kansas versus Marsh. So there was this continuing question, however, about whether or not this issue was one of state or federal law. And the reason why it matters goes back to another Supreme Court decision that Justice Scalia wondered if the Kansas Supreme Court had read outside the Eighth Amendment context, dealing with Michigan versus Long. This says that it's a Fourth Amendment case, but it also mentions that it allows the Supreme Court to review a state Supreme Court decision unless the court explicitly applied state law to reach the outcome. The language is there needs to be a clear and express bona fide state ground in order to say that the decision of the state court was one on state law. Without that, there's essentially a presumption that the decision was made under federal law, and therefore the Supreme Court can review it. And Justice Scalia took this point very simply, saying, well, that the Supreme Court of Kansas said this was decided under the Eighth Amendment, therefore we're going to take them at their word. It's an Eighth Amendment case. Interestingly, Chief Justice Roberts had not interjected much at the outset. In fact, asked the state of Kansas in the Gleason, in response to the Gleason presentation, no questions. But when Gleason's attorney came up, and this issue about Michigan versus Long was referenced here, Chief Justice Roberts became a bit more animated. He began asking, well, isn't this the whole point of Michigan versus Long, so that we're not here questioning whether a citation to the Eighth Amendment here but a state Supreme Court case there, you know, really means that they were relying on state law as opposed to federal law. And this issue may seem to be a bit far removed from the death penalty issues related to this case, but it actually appears to be at the core of what's going on here. There was a number of questions from Justices Breyer, Kennedy, Ginsburg, and Sotomayor raising this issue of remand to the Kansas Supreme Court to essentially say, well, there is no Eighth Amendment issue here, but there needs to be a determination of whether state law provides an independent basis to say that an affirmative instruction with respect to mitigating circumstances is required. And Justice Alito sort of refuted this, questioning why remand would be necessary when simply a state court says something interesting about state law and it's not clear whether it was relied on state or federal grounds, especially when there was collateral review available under state law. But this, as I said, it gets to a sort of bigger issue with respect to who is responsible for the changes in death penalty jurisprudence. One of the most insightful questions I thought from the oral argument came relatively early on when Justice Alito had commented that there is a question of responsibility when a court says that it's citing to the federal constitution to say that this is why this outcome in a particular case is compelled. And so by relying on the Eighth Amendment as opposed to relying upon Kansas state law to impose an affirmative jury instruction, the Kansas Supreme Court was essentially saying that it is the Eighth Amendment that is responsible for what would result in putting two-thirds of the inmates on death row's death penalty convictions, throwing them into jeopardy. Justice Scalia sort of speculated on this further, asking counsel in the case whether there are retention elections in Kansas. And upon acknowledgement that there were, Justice Scalia had commented, it may be the case that, you know, Kansas is not as opposed to the death penalty as Justice Breyer is. And they may not like the fact that the Kansas Supreme Court has essentially said that Kansas state law requires an affirmative instruction that gets rid of the death convictions or the death sentences in these cases. And so it's much more palatable for them to say that, well, their hands were tied by the Eighth Amendment. And I thought that was one of the more interesting exchanges at the beginning of oral argument on this affirmative instruction question, and really kind of speaks to the broader context in which we're seeing the death penalty revisited by a number of state legislatures and also the court itself. Turning specifically to the jury instructions, there was varying views among the justices about the level of confusion about the burden of proof with regard to mitigating circumstances and how a juror would react to the instructions that were there. Justice Sotomayor sort of took the position that since there was a number of references to guilt beyond a reasonable doubt with respect to aggravating circumstances, that a juror would have concluded that that's the standard to provide. Indeed, that's the argument essentially heard from the respondents in the case, that this was the only standard that the jurors were familiar with throughout the course of the trial. But the state responded to that essentially saying that, again, sort of going back to the have you read our cases line, to a Supreme Court decision in Boyd versus California that essentially said that when there's no reasonable likelihood that the jury applied the standard in a way that precluded giving effect to all the relevant mitigating evidence, that there would be a problem here, even if there wasn't an explicit instruction, because states are free to design and conform and structure and shape the consideration of mitigating evidence. Justice Scalia took the view that you could rely upon the maxim of interpretation, inclusio unis est exclusio ulterioris, to say that the inclusion of one thing, meaning that you are told that aggravating factors need to be proved beyond guilt, with guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, excludes mitigating factors from that. Justice Sotomayor doubted if any of a reasonable juror would have heard of that maxim before. And then the state, and this is a sort of theme throughout the rest of the argument, sort of emphasized that the jury instructions on with respect to mitigating circumstances need to be considered holistically, that there was a catch-all provision, that there was a mercy instruction, that the prosecution emphasized that it was its burden to show aggravating factors beyond a reasonable doubt, and that taken together under the Supreme Court's jurisprudence, this was sufficient. There was some interesting follow-on discussion from that about what a trial judge would say if asked what the burden with respect to mitigating factors was. Justice Ginsburg had sort of suggested that she was troubled by the lack of there being an express instruction. And there was some questions about drawing a negative inference. But at bottom, the state simply rejected the notion that this case was decided on the basis of state law, and it emphasized the danger of not correcting the Eighth Amendment issue here, which, as I indicated at the beginning of the comments, would impact two-thirds of the inmates on death row in Kansas, and probably, as Justice Kennedy had alluded to a few times, inform the death penalty jurisprudence of other states. The remainder of the argument really dealt with the issue of severance, which is unique to the Carr cases in terms of whether the Carr's brothers should have been tried separately as opposed to jointly. There seemed to be, I think, compared to the affirmative instruction question, less contention among the justices on this particular issue. There was lots of question about the standard of review and whether it was just harmless error. The state had emphasized that each defendant received individualized sentencing. There were separate jury instructions. There was a separate verdict form. And ultimately, and this was a question that was asked, you know, I think from Justice Breyer, that there ultimately was not any evidence that was admitted that would not have come in through some other form. That was the state's position. There was some discussion, Justice Scalia seemed to focus on this, about the applicability of the Eighth Amendment to questions of evidentiary admissibility and whether this was really more of a due process issue, which again gets to this kind of growing involvement of the Eighth Amendment in different areas of capital cases and the broader sort of questions about the acceptability or the comfort level that different jurisdictions have with capital punishment. There was an argument then when, and Justice Kagan also struggled to some extent and pressed the Craig lawyer on this. What was the actual prejudice from particular evidence that resulted as a function of trying the Carr brothers together as opposed to separately? And the Reginald Craig lawyer kept making the point that the real issue with respect to that was that constantly bringing in evidence that he was a corrupting influence on his brother sort of intimated that that was the reason why that the jury gave him the death penalty, and that since there was no clear testimony about who actually pulled the trigger to these victims, whether it was Reginald or Jonathan, that essentially the jury could have just cast all these aspersions onto Reginald, presumed that he was the one that pulled the trigger because he was such a corrupting influence, and that he got the death penalty as a function of being such a corrupting influence on his brother, and that evidence wouldn't have come in otherwise. Justice Scalia really pushed back on this, though, pretty strongly, saying, recounting the facts with which I began, you know, do you really think that the focus of the jury here was on who pulled the trigger, or was it on the sort of heinous circumstances of these crimes? The Carr lawyer was very insistent on this, that this was a function of this, the corrupting influence and the spillover prejudice that came from that. I think that ultimately sort of sums up what was discussed at the argument without going too much over my time, and I look forward to elaborating on this with further questions.
Thank you so much, Mr. Hahn. We'll now open the floor to questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open. We've got about a full 40 minutes left in our budgeted time here. Before we check in with the audience, let me just remind our callers or tell them that tomorrow at 3 p.m. we'll host a teleforum conference call and we'll be discussing lawyers representing unsympathetic clients. Might apply to some of today's clients in the Supreme Court. That's tomorrow, though, at 3 p.m., lawyers representing unsympathetic clients. Today, death penalty in the U.S. Supreme Court. We've got just one question pending. If you want to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's now take our first call. Caller, we can't hear you. You might have your telephone muted. Do you want to take your phone off mute?
Yes, hello?
Yeah, we can hear you now.
Antoinette Jefferson, the mercy rule, could you explain it?
Sure. So there was actually a little bit of a discussion about this and whether the mercy instruction was sufficient and what was actually the standard of proof required for it. The state took the position that the mercy instruction is really an act of grace, and therefore you can't presume that there's a beyond a reasonable doubt standard that has to be triggered before you apply a mercy instruction. It's simply an act of grace that an individual juror would come to a conclusion of, and they pointed also to another part in the instructions that emphasized that individual jurors could come to individual conclusions about mitigating evidence, and it wasn't the case that they all had to find the same type of mitigating evidence sufficiently mitigating. So again, kind of speaking to this question of mercy being an act of grace, whereas when Neil Contial argued the opposing position with respect to the instructions, he was talking about how before you would even get to the catch-all instruction or the mercy instruction, there needed to be this sort of threshold determination in the juror's mind what standard was going to apply before I even applied a particular type of jury instruction, whether it was guilt beyond a reasonable doubt or preponderance as it is in the federal system. And so it was interesting to hear this discussion about the mercy rule and this idea, somewhat curious idea, that there needed to be a finding of mercy beyond a reasonable doubt before you could give mercy, which is really just finding that the enough of the surrounding mitigating circumstances of this particular defendant warranted mercy from the capital sentence.
Okay, the Eighth Amendment. Thank you.
Sure.
Once again, our lines are open. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. While we're waiting to see if others ring in, let me ask you, Mr. Hahn, you mentioned sort of the broader context of death penalty cases. The court, of course, has taken just a number of death penalty cases in the recent past. I'm wondering if you want to say more about where these cases might fit in terms of the Supreme Court jurisprudence. Recently, just the cases I can think of, Glossop was the lethal injection cocktail case. They've discussed death penalty in juveniles in the Roper case and mental capacity in the Atkins case. And then there was the Florida case that dealt with Atkins, I guess.
Right. No, the Supreme Court has certainly taken on a number of death cases in recent terms, but also interesting phenomena going on at the state level as well. You have the Connecticut Supreme Court in August in a 4-3 decision found that the state's death penalty no longer comports with societal values and serves no valid purpose as a punishment. And this decision just came a few months after the Nebraska legislature voted to eliminate capital punishment. And so then also you have this Kansas Supreme Court decision with respect to saying that essentially, the death sentences of 2/3 of the inmates on death row in Kansas are invalid because there wasn't an affirmative instruction that you don't need to find the mitigating factors by beyond a reasonable doubt. And it's It's interesting to see how the questions played out with respect to this broader context. Justice Alito, in oral argument in the Glossop case, referenced a guerrilla war against the death penalty. This is something that both Justices Scalia and Thomas had indicated in existence as early as Simmons versus South Carolina in their dissent in 1994. It was referencing that this idea that there wasn't a full frontal assault, if you will, on the death penalty itself, but that there were a number of different groups opposed to capital punishment that were trying to explore a variety of legal avenues that could exploit weaknesses in the administration of capital punishment so that the net effect would be that the court would chip away at capital punishment and ultimately get rid of it. And we saw in the Glossop decision both Justices Breyer and Ginsburg be very explicit that they think that capital punishment is unconstitutional. And I think one way to possibly see some of the questions that were asked today in the context of this broader debate is in this Michigan v. Long discussion about whether the Kansas Supreme Court was really making an Eighth Amendment decision when it said that an affirmative instruction was required, or whether this was simply an interpretation of Kansas state law. If you say it's an Eighth Amendment issue, which people who are opposed to capital punishment may want it to be, there needs to be essentially five votes on the Supreme Court who are prepared to either substantially clarify or potentially even overrule a number of Supreme Court decisions that have reaffirmed time and again, as brought up at oral argument today, that the states possess discretion with respect to how they set up and control the introduction of mitigating evidence and are allowed to have an efficient system for administration of the death penalty. However, if you realize that there may not be an appetite on the court to say something even, as Justice Breyer said in oral argument, the court's never said before, and revisit all of these cases, you might be inclined to take the approach that it was sort of suggested through Justices Sotomayor and Ginsburg's questions, which was that this was really the Kansas Supreme Court interpreting Kansas law, and that we should remand the case to say, here's what the Eighth Amendment says for now, but you made these interesting points about state law, and you should be allowed to flesh that out. And there was certainly an acknowledgement among the justices, and again, Justice Kennedy had mentioned this, I think, more than once, that other states are taking cues on this, that they are following how the death penalty is being handled and being challenged in other states. And if there is a sort of signal from the Supreme Court that these issues about affirmative instructions are interesting or may even be required under certain state laws, and that the court's even willing to sort of chip away at Michigan versus Long to say that, that might then further embolden other jurisdictions to impose affirmative instructions on the death penalty, or, as Justice Breyer talked about in oral argument, retroactively apply this requirement, which could then invalidate more death sentences. So it really is interesting to see this debate, which may seem arcane, maybe is not the right word, but just a sort of ancillary issue dealing with whether a state Supreme Court is deciding something under federal or state grounds. But seeing that sort of procedural, almost procedural question, quasi-procedural question, informing the tactical strategy, if you will, in this argument over the death penalty and its broader application.
Once again, if you have a question, our lines are wide open. Push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. You mentioned two things there I want to pick up on while we here's a question from the audience. So I will demur and turn to the audience once again. Caller, you might have your telephone muted. If your phone is muted, you need to come off mute. We can't hear you.
Hi there. Is that working now?
Yep, we can hear you now. Go right ahead.
Hi, Will. Michael Bushbacher.
Hey, how are you?
I'm well. What do you think the breakdown is going to be in terms of reading the tea leaves from oral argument? How do you think justices are going to split on this one?
You know, it's interesting. I thought it was interesting, as I mentioned toward the beginning of my comments, that Chief Justice Roberts didn't initially say anything toward the state, and really anything in the argument, until this Michigan v. Long discussion came up. And sort of making the point. I thought the whole point of Michigan versus Long was that we wouldn't be sitting here parsing out what a state Supreme Court, whether it was really decided under state or federal law. So there seemed to be some questions about that, especially for Justice Sotomayor to sort of lead off with that, and for Justice Scalia to question whether they've read their cases. I think there could be a lineup sort of more along the lines that we saw in Glossa, but with respect to this issue about the applicability of or whether the Kansas Supreme Court was making a decision under state or federal law. As to the severance piece, there seemed to be, I think, less contention among the justices on this. A number of them had referenced a sort of harmless error standard. There seemed to be a general reluctance to question the general acceptance of joinder in criminal cases. So I don't necessarily see that particular piece of it being as contentious, though. And the fact that, say, Justice Kagan, for example, was having such a difficult time identifying what specific evidence Reginald Carr found prejudicial about having his case tried with Jonathan. So I think you might see a more mixed lineup than the sort of stereotypical lineup on that particular question, but it seemed to me that on the affirmative instruction question, you might see the more stereotypical lineup.
Thanks.
Go ahead. Do you have a follow-up?
Oh, no. I think that answered my question pretty well. Thank you.
Okay. Once again, if you'd like to ask a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. You mentioned a couple things in your remarks just before. One about Glossop and Justice Breyer's dissent signaling that he's open to the idea that the death penalty is unconstitutional under the Eighth Amendment. Were there any echoes of that either in the briefings and the arguments that were being proposed today, or even in the questions from the bench? And I'd like to hear you discuss that type of writing in Justice Breyer's dissent and what ripples it might cause in the states, in state legislatures, in state courts.
Right. So it's interesting. In Justice Breyer's dissent in Glossop, he wrote more than 40 pages about what he viewed as the so-called constitutional defects of capital punishment, including its lack of reliability in his view, its arbitrariness, the cruelty of the excessive delays in carrying it out, and how its decline in frequency has likely made it an unusual punishment that violates the Eighth Amendment. And what's interesting about some of those critiques is they again go back to what you hear on the other side, has been called the guerrilla war characterization of some of these critiques, whether it be the lack of reliability or the arbitrariness or the excessive delays, has come about as a function of impositions made on the application of the death penalty. So it's sort of from the perspective of some, it may be that what's happened here is that those who are opposed to capital punishment have imposed these kinds of difficulties in administrating the death penalty to then proceed to challenge those impositions on the administration of the death penalty as making it more cruel or now unusual, in the words of Justice Breyer's dissent. In terms of the questions at oral argument today, I guess this came up somewhat in passing when Justice Scalia asked about whether the Kansas Supreme Court justices were subjected to retention elections, and he had commented somewhat off the cuff that, well, turns out, or maybe, that the Kansas voters are not as opposed to the death penalty as Justice Breyer is, and they may be upset about the fact that their state Supreme Court has understood their state law to require an affirmative instruction that invalidates the death sentences of 2/3 of the people on death row in the state. Much easier for them to say that their hands were tied by the Eighth Amendment, and it sounds as if that the respondents essentially want the court to do that, or not the respondents, but that the you'd want the court to sort of take care of that and bless that approach for the state. So that it is interesting to see that sort of lineup, and I can't help but also notice just how much of Justice Scalia's concurring opinion in Kansas versus Marsh is still was underneath some of the surface of the argument today. I mean, he, in that particular case, he had called into question, it's a somewhat controversial concurrence, he called into question about whether the death penalty is ever actually executed an innocent person, and question some of the reliability arguments and some of the studies that have been supported in that respect. But again, it sort of goes back to his rhetorical question of, have they read our cases? I mean, the court has been clear time and again, as he said in Glossop, that the people have voted to exact the death penalty as punishment for the most serious of crimes. It's been upheld time and again. And yet, time and again, as Justice Scalia says, that there's a vocal minority on the court that insists things have now radically changed, and it's sought to replace the judgment of the people. And you kind of got that when Justice Breyer said, and I was rather surprised at how candid he was in saying this, that, you know, well, we haven't held that the Eighth Amendment requires an affirmative instruction up to now, but maybe now we do, as if to say that something that wasn't required yesterday may be required today. So I, in those respects, I thought there was that underlying tension about the death penalty that sort of percolated in oral argument.
Very good. If you have a question, we've still got time for some more questions. Push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We have one question that's come in by email, if I can put my fingers on it here. Flipping through my computer screens here. An emailer, caller, writes, Mr. Hahn, since Scalia seems to think the Kansas Supreme Court doesn't like the penalty, if SCOTUS rules in favor of Kansas, could the Kansas Supreme Court find another way to block the death sentences? For example, by looking at other errors the Kansas Supreme Court found, but that SCOTUS did not review and conclude they were not harmless.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, as I indicated, there are unaddressed issues here. For example, the confrontation issue with respect to the admission of potential hearsay in the penalty phase was not addressed by the court. That was in the Carr case. And also there was this discussion about whether you wouldn't necessarily remand the case to have the Kansas Supreme Court make a decision about whether they were actually making a decision under state law by saying, you would say that the Supreme Court says that there isn't an Eighth Amendment requirement for an affirmative instruction, but maybe you were intimating that there was a requirement under Kansas state law, and we remand for you to flesh that out. There was a discussion about why that avenue would be pursued if there is sort of collateral vehicles. Justice Alito raised this question, and the response to it essentially was that there are a number of procedural changes that happen if people try to raise these issues collaterally with the Kansas Supreme Court. Different presumptions would be in play that could change the posture of the case that might result in how these questions actually get reviewed. So it seemed like the clearest path for those who want to have the Kansas Supreme Court decision stand, which is different than having the state of Kansas win. The state of Kansas was challenging what the Kansas Supreme Court said. That the clearest path to do that would be to say that there is an Eighth Amendment requirement and that the Kansas Supreme Court was deciding on Eighth Amendment grounds, which sort of allows you to be, I think, arguably consistent with Michigan versus Long, but then read something into the Eighth Amendment that forces you to confront prior precedent. Or you could say that, as has been suggested, the oral argument by Justice Breyer and others, that you could continue to affirm that the Eighth Amendment doesn't speak to this issue, but that state law might, and so you should remand and flesh it out, whether collateral or I would be on direct in that case, and the Kansas Supreme Court could then proceed further. But the state sounded like they would be very much opposed to that, and they hope also that the court's decision sort of obviates the need to address the confrontation issue if the case were to go back to Kansas as well. That was brought up a few times.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. The lines are open. You've mentioned a couple times the perceived guerrilla war against the death penalty. I want to ask a question that might go beyond your knowledge, certainly goes beyond this case, but more generally to the practice of law in these cases. How broad, are these the same groups, the same number of attorneys who are bringing these cases pretty persistently, pretty consistently? And are they the same groups generally defending these? I'm wondering how, do we have here in these cases, which seem to occupy a lot of the Supreme Court's time, there's small numbers of people on either side waging pitched battles?
There are certainly public interest groups that are consistently interested in these cases. I think that there are certain organizations that are committed either officially or unofficially to moving these types of cases through the pipeline, as is common throughout public interest law. People look for test cases and they look for the right plaintiffs. That is something that's common under public interest law. There are pluses and minuses to that. Minus might be forum shopping, for example. But I do think that what you're seeing is perhaps an attitude that's not necessarily confined to just certain public interest organizations, but is confined to a segment of the legal profession as well, that just seems fatigued, if you will, by all of these death penalty issues. There has been some thought about the fact that this is just something that, as was said at oral argument today, the Supreme Court sees death penalty cases all of the time. And if you look back to Justice Brennan's comments, for example, or Justice Marshall's comments about the death penalty earlier on, when they found the death penalty to raise a constitutional problem, they just found, or Justice Blackmun, they found themselves to just be fatigued with the fact that they've seen all these death penalty cases. They're not convinced that of the death penalty's merit. And so there is, I think, a segment not just of organizations, but also of the legal profession that just has become exhausted with the death penalty, and they just plain don't believe in it as a just punishment anymore.
And yet, I think public opinion still supports the death penalty.
Right. I mean, that is the fact. I mean, now there are 30 states that have either formally abolished the death penalty or have not carried out an execution in more than 8 years, but that isn't necessarily the same as public opinion on the issue. And it's interesting, one of the sort of, I guess, inadvertent effects of all of these impositions on the administration of the death penalty is that the death penalty has become essentially reserved for the most heinous crimes. So although there are more vehicles to attack the death penalty, more criticisms that can be made as a function of the delays in carrying it out, for example, and the decline in its frequency, what you have is a situation, though, where the death penalty is being implicated in cases where the facts are just as they are in the Carr case. I mean, they're just grisly. If you look, for example, at some of the internal, some of the politics that led up to the Connecticut Supreme Court's abolishment of the death penalty, there's absolutely horrific murder that happened with the Pettit family in Connecticut that raised all sorts of questions about the death penalty in that state. There was a support politically, I think, for getting rid of the death penalty, but the facts of that case, and it had just captured the attention of so many in the state, raised a lot of questions about retroactively applying any legislative ban to the death penalty. They're just simply support just evaporated as a function of the facts of those cases. And then, the Connecticut Supreme Court kind of come in and without the concerns of being politically accountable, are able to sort of clean the slate and strike the death penalty completely. And I think that might be something that admittedly is speculation, but is, as Justice Scalia said, is sort of speculation with respect to these retention elections that, maybe the Kansas Supreme Court justices will have to be politically accountable if they make a decision under state law, and that might finally allow the majority that still supports the use of capital punishment, at least in some cases, to say that this has gone too far. As was said by the state, I was just going to say, as was said by the state in concluding to the oral argument, there was the Constitution does require fairness in all respects, but it also requires finality, and that the disruption that would be caused by continuing to, impose one day after another requirement on death sentences would end up creating so much disruption that there wouldn't be any finality.
Let me make a final call for questions here. If you have a question, we're happy to take your question. We've got about 15 more minutes. Push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Looks like we've got one more question, so let's check in with the audience again.
Has anybody made the argument that given the fact that there were only 18 million private murders in the 20th century and there were perhaps 180 million uses of the death penalty by various governments against their own people, that it tends to be overused?
Well, that certainly was not a point that was raised today. And it's interesting to hear an argument that it's overused, seeing as in recent years, as Justice Breyer's dissent in Glossop identified, the decline in frequency sort of speaks to it being more unusual for purposes of the Eighth Amendment. Although certainly I could see how the position that the death penalty would be overused, maybe in a more macro sense, looking further back historically and then broadening it to include other countries, might lead to the argument that its overuse leads to an injudicious use of it. But it does seem to be that the trajectory of those opposed to the death penalty on Eighth Amendment grounds now, that the fact that it's used so sparingly and its decline in frequency makes it more of an unusual punishment and therefore more susceptible to an Eighth Amendment challenge.
We've got another question pending. If you want to join the queue, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone.
Hey, Will and Dean, this is Brandon Smith here. Will, I was wondering if you could, you started to bring this up a second ago, if you could talk maybe more about the role of the judicial selection process plays in how some of these cases are decided at the state level.
Sure. So, I mean, Justice Scalia had made a comment, an oral argument about, and he characterized it admittedly as speculation, but just that judicial retention here could play a role in the thinking of how judges decide some of these cases. If they are concerned that they're going to have to be politically accountable for reading a requirement into law that is unpopular, that it's much easier to say that their hands were tied by the federal constitution. A sort of similar dynamic occurred in, I believe it was 2006, in Iowa with respect to broadening the definition of marriage to include same-sex couples and the retention elections that occurred with respect to those judges and what happened there. So there is certainly a connection in that sense between how you would approach the decision necessarily and how that might play out politically. So that could be some of the underlying thinking going on here about who's really responsible for this outcome in Kansas. And I mean, obviously, it's not the case in every part of the country. Sometimes the insulation of the judiciary I suppose you would say that what happened in Connecticut, for example, would be consistent with this because there the judiciary isn't subjected to retention elections. So they were able to essentially clean up, if you will, the fact that there was some political appetite to eliminate the death penalty, but not total because of the facts of an ongoing prosecution and then death penalty issue with the Pettit family that really evaporated support for a wholesale elimination of it, even retroactively. But because the judiciary is isolated from the political accountability, they didn't have to worry about experiencing backlash for eliminating the death penalty wholesale, though it was a 4-3 decision in Connecticut. So that might be a way to sort of contrast what happened in Kansas and Connecticut is this issue about judicial retention, judicial selection, political accountability, and then, the effect of actually the majority getting to have its say on these issues and how that affects the courts. So
looks like we're about out of questions. We're close to out of time. Let me give you a minute or two, Mr. Honda, to express any final thoughts you have here.
Well, I just want to say thank you. it was very enjoyable to attend the argument today, and I appreciate the opportunity to get to speak with other Federalist Society members. I found the arguments to be quite interesting, a continuation of what's sometimes characterized as the death is different jurisprudence under the Eighth Amendment and all the unique rules that apply to it, and seeing how some of these underlying debates about the death penalty continue to percolate, and the fact that they, while they're they're playing out in a political process, it does seem that justices are certainly aware of them, and it may even inform their thinking, at least with respect to the questions they ask in oral argument, and we'll see if it manifests itself in how they decide the case.
Will Haughton, thank you so much, not only for your time on the call today, but of course for attending the oral argument. These were excellent set of comments and responses to questions. I also want to thank the audience for dialing in and for your questions. A reminder to the audience that our next scheduled telephone call is tomorrow at 3 p.m. when we'll be talking about lawyers representing unsympathetic clients. But until the next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.